From WYPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Maryland Morning. Today, we look at a program in the Baltimore City State's Attorney's Office that, instead of sending accused street prostitutes to trial, helps them find what they need to turn their lives around.
They need the support. They need the hug. They need the crackers. They need whatever we do to say, you're worthy. You can look in the mirror and promise that person that you can do better.
Plus, theater critic Jaewon Russick has returned from the Contemporary American Theater Festival in Shepherdstown, West Virginia, with 5 reviews in hand. And Tom Hall talks with Tiffany Yannick, author of the new novel Land of Love and Drowning. Set in the Virgin Islands and spanning 6 decades, it follows a family struggling with the search for personal and national identity. First, the news.
I'm producer Jamila Kay. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock. That's on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming at WYPR.org. Now, on with the show.
It's Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. In 2006, a group of residents in Baltimore's Curtis Bay neighborhood had a problem. Prostitutes stood on street corners waiting for johns. They'd be picked up for prostitution by the police, only to return to the same streets. Citizens formed a task force. What grew out of it was a program rooted in an approach called problem-solving justice. Instead of moving those facing prostitution charges through the criminal justice system, it gives them access to services that might keep them out of it and off the streets. It began in 2009 within the Baltimore City State's Attorney's Office and can now serve about 80 people at any given time. Corey Shadema, an associate professor at the University of Maryland School of Social Work, recently co-authored a scholarly article on what she learned during 120 hours of interviews with people who have been through the program. I spoke with her and with Sue Deal, a social worker who's been part of the pretrial diversion program since its beginning. Deal told us that, unlike many diversion programs that require community service, this has one key requirement. The participants have to meet with a social worker.
And that's where I and my colleagues come in, because we will then meet with them on a regular basis. They also meet with their pretrial agent. They also do have a drug assessment.
But when you're meeting with them, what...
What are we doing?
Yeah, what's happening?
We're talking with them about themselves. We're asking them to say, what would you need to do to change things in your life? What do you want to change? How do you want to get to the next level? And what do we have in the city to offer you to help you get there? 90% of the time, they need either mental health or substance abuse treatment, or both. They need a place to sleep that's safe. They need some counseling. They need medical care. And up until very recently, they needed insurance. They need an ID. The people we see are really at the very bottom of have. They got nothing. So the idea is, how do we get them to the resources that they can use? We now are fortunate to have the ability to give them bus passes, to get them simple transportation, to get from wherever they are to a resource. Because if you can't get there, and sometimes it's a long walk, it's not going to happen.
Professor Shadema, tell us what the profile is of the participants. Who do they tend to be demographically?
So we do know that demographically, at least of the people coming into being arrested for prostitution in Baltimore, we've got about 90% women, about 9% trans women, and 1% men. So in terms of the gender distribution, which was, I would say, somewhat surprising given the task force was pretty much prepared that everyone was going to be women. And so they were somewhat surprised that there was such a large percentage of trans women among the people being arrested for prostitution. The other thing that people are often surprised about is the age of people who are being arrested. So in terms of my sample, we've interviewed people from the ages of 18 to their mid-50s, and the average age for is 34. So often that's older than people think of when they think of people who are being arrested for street-based sex work.
So the people
who participate in the diversion program, are they representative of all the people involved in prostitution?
No, that's a great question. What we're looking at, the people who are arrested for prostitution in Baltimore are people who are arrested for street-based prostitution, and they're largely engaged in survival sex work. So they are in prostitution to meet their most basic needs, housing, food, if they have a drug addiction. And so I would be very careful about saying that they're representative. There are many other forms of sex work, including prostitution, where people might be making reasoned choices. They're engaged in as a career choice, or they're not encountering the same kind of dangers and difficulties that the women who are arrested for this kind of prostitution are.
Do you have a sense of the profile of those who say yes to participating in the program versus those who pass? I mean, is there some identifying characteristics of those who want to do this?
Initially, the thought was that many of these women would not accept the program. It was really a big surprise to find that that hardly ever happens.
Well, are they not a fine of up to $500 or up to a year in jail if convicted of prostitution?
However, that's not common. Fines are rarely given because what they do is prostitute to get the money to pay the fine. So a fine is kind of contra. It doesn't make a lot of sense. The jail time is usually cut sufficiently, but they want help. They want to be different. These women are traumatized. They are frequently victims of child sexual abuse. They are suffering from PTSD, not unlike what we hear about from Iraq and Afghanistan. These are people who want something different but have just not got the strength to get there.
And does there tend to be, for the whole group, one service that, by and large, is the most important in changing things around for them?
Yeah. I would say if they have a good trauma counselor, somebody who can help them work through and work with the trauma that they have experienced, if they can get to that place that they can talk about the trauma that they've experienced, that's not something we can do. That's not something that gets done in 90 days. If we can get them to develop a positive support system, and what we find is that for those that do most often succeed, they do have some support system left, be it a family member, be it a sponsor, be it a neighbor. There is somebody who is a positive influence and still in their life.
On WIPR, this is Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cass, speaking with Corey Stema, an associate professor at the University of Maryland School of Social Work. And also with me is Sue Deal, a social worker who works in the specialized pretrial diversion program in the Baltimore State's Attorney's Office. Professor Stema, you've written that for nearly all the participants, what was most helpful was being treated by the social workers with compassion and respect. And that was almost more important than the kind of services we've been talking about. Tell me how you know that.
Well, we did interviews with participants who are in the program. So we spoke with 21 people who were participating in the program, five of whom we spoke to twice. I've also done interviews in other settings. So I've spoken to, I'd say, probably about 75 women who are in these types of programs, and it's something that I do hear across the board. And what that says to me is that, in general, women engaged in prostitution are used to being treated poorly. They're used to being treated poorly by social services who, when they seek help or when they're mandated to go to help, they're used to being treated poorly by the criminal justice system. This is almost unanimous that most people noted that when they were treated with dignity, when they were treated, often they use the term being treated as a human being, right? So this is the most pivotal or most important thing to them, is that someone has treated them as a human being. And I think that that says something about the way we treat people overall. So you don't really need to be in a specialized diversion program. We could, it provides some advice about how we could rethink, even for people who are unable to access these programs or for locations where we don't have programs or if people are capped out or ineligible, that one of the things that really makes a difference in their willingness to engage with the program and when they seem to be satisfied with services is being treated with dignity. And that's something that really doesn't cost any money.
The program is envisioned as lasting 90 days for its participant, 90 days to turn their lives around. Many of them have suffered years of abuse and struggled with addiction, and some have health and mental health problems. Sue Deal, about how many of them are able to come out of the program and hold down a job and not reenter the criminal justice system?
Of the people who are in the program, probably 50% do actually succeed in getting to a point that they can be given the NALPROS at the end of the 90 days, or at some point. We do extensions. If somebody is getting there, but they aren't quite where they want to be yet or where we think they need to be able to say that they have successfully done what they need to do, then we have an opportunity to say, let's extend you for 30 days, 60 days, 90 days, whatever.
Now, NALPROS means that the charge against them is not
can
is
be
not
expunged.
And can be expunged.
Yes.
But what constitutes success? I just said job. I don't know whether that's what you all consider success.
No. We're not saying job. Job is something that happens very infrequently. But it does happen, thank goodness. But most of these people need so much time to get well before they are employable. They need to be drug-free for a small period of time. They need to be able to get their GED. They need to get their ID. They need to get their... They need so many things that going back to work is is at least 6 months down the road. Now, that does not mean everybody, but there are those who go back to work within that 90 days is a small number. Our job is to get them on the path to employment.
And that's what you call success, if you see they're on a path.
Yes.
One of my interests in this research is finding out from the participants in the program themselves, from the defendants, what do they consider success? And I would say one of the things, particularly from such a short program of 90 days, and you pointed out that often there is a history of problems that they're trying to solve that's much longer than the 90 days, is the idea that they have an address and that they know where to turn to. So if someone can leave the program with the tools to know, okay, if I'm ready for the next step, whether it's finding a job or looking for a house or moving from an inpatient program to an outpatient, I would say that one of our measures of success for these programs should be that they know where to turn and that they know where to turn where people will treat them well and will give them advice that's valuable advice that might help them stay on a path. And many of the respondents that we spoke to in our study, many of the defendants, after they had finished, they really expressed a desire to stay in contact either with Sue or with other people who were in the program. And when we interviewed five of the participants after they had finished, they were indeed still in contact. And I would say that's a measure of success, that you don't, you know, return to the streets if you're in trouble. You have another address.
One of the things that you, Professor, you spoke with a woman, 34-year-old named Maria, who told you, quote, I wish there was more programs that actually was offered without having to go through the courts, close quote. And you raise that question. Why is it necessary to be in a court-controlled program in order to get these services?
Well, I think that a lot of people are either unaware that the services exist. That's one thing that we found. So people were connected to services that prior to their entrance they didn't know. But a lot of times people, even if they're aware, they're unable to access the programs. So there is no one out there who's helping them do all of the things that Sue's been talking about to help them get the ID or get the insurance that would allow them to then receive the mental health services. And so one of the suggestions, and I would agree, I think Maria gave a very astute suggestion. I've heard from other people that I've interviewed, you know, if these services were available to me before, then I might have made a change earlier. And so I think that that's one of the implications of what I'm finding, that it might be beneficial to have some of the services that people need more readily available to them, advertise more to make it easier for people to access the services, and then maybe they would not be in the situation where they're arrested and charged and in the criminal justice system.
I agree, but I also believe that there are resources out there. The Franciscan Center, I mean, our Daily Bread, or the Healthcare for the Homeless. I mean, there are many places that people can go, but they don't, for whatever reason, do that without somebody saying, hey, look at yourself, stop for a minute, take a look. Let's talk about what you can do. What do you want to do? And they will say to me, I need this. I need that. They know what they need. But getting that energy together to go and do it. Well, a lot of us know things we need to be doing. We don't get the energy to do it until somebody points out that, hey, you need to wash the windows or you need to do whatever. You know, it's a real life phenomena, and they become... If you're prostituting, your vision of yourself has moved far down the line. You know, the energy is just not there. The trauma history is kicking in big time. They need the support. They need the hug. They need the crackers. They need whatever we do to say, you're worthy. You're worthy. You can look in the mirror and promise that person that you can do better. That you have the power. And that's what we say. You have to incorporate a change to make it happen. And I think that's where the fear, a little bit, there's a fear of going to jail. But many of these people have been to jail. It's not going to be a new phenomenon. We do know if we get you first time, the chances that you succeed are better than if you have been in the business for a while.
So do you see this program continuing as it is? What's the future?
I don't know. Our grant is running out. We have a change in leadership coming to the state's attorney's office. I don't know where we will be.
We'll check in with you.
We hope.
And I think across the country there is growing interest in these kind of programs. Like I said, there's one existing in Philadelphia. There's a delegation from Delaware that just visited the Philadelphia program. I got a call from New Orleans that they're thinking of looking at it. So I think sometimes the existing resources and political constellation can impact whether a given program exists. But I think overall there's been a growing interest in these kinds of programs. And in thinking a little bit differently about how the criminal justice system responds, both from a perspective of can we be more efficacious, right? Can we do a better job? If our goal is having people desist from prostitution, can we make sure that that works? And I think also from a moral perspective, right? We're a little uncomfortable sometimes. The criminal justice system and the actors in it sometimes are uncomfortable with carrying out the punishments that, as Sue noted, don't really have any impact. So people are doing something that they themselves would prefer not to be doing. And so I think that there's more recognition that it might not make sense to be punishing people for doing something that they would prefer not to do, but rather it's both more efficacious and more ethical to offer them services that
probably less expensive.
And certainly less expensive.
Well, yeah. I appreciate you both talking to us about it. Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Cori Shdema is an associate professor at the University of Maryland School of Social Work. Sue Deal is a social worker in the Specialized Pretrial Diversion Program in the Baltimore City State's Attorney's Office. We've got a link to Professor Shadema's scholarly articles about the diversion program on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. More of this interview there, too, including the vulnerability of transgender street prostitutes. I'm Sheila Cast, ahead on Maryland Morning, a debut novel about freedom, love, and identity across generations. Stay with us on 88.1.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. That's wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Thanks for listening.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Every summer, our theater critic, J. Wynn Russick, makes the pilgrimage to Shepherdstown, West Virginia, to check out the Contemporary American Theater Festival. The festival is an important showcase for new American plays. Judy brings us this review of this year's offerings.
While headlines continue to report malfeasance at the Veterans Affairs Department, playwright Charles Fuller's up-to-the-minute play, One Night, makes a powerful case on stage at the Contemporary American Theater Festival. Fuller's drama is one of five cutting-edge plays in this 24th annual New Play Festival in Shepherdstown, West Virginia, just across the state line, about 30 minutes from Frederick. The subjects of this year's plays vary from assisted suicide to artificial intelligence, but the theme of justice crops up in all five. Nowhere is it more evident, however, than in Fuller's One Night. Fuller won the 1982 Pulitzer Prize for A Soldier's Story, and he also focuses on the military here. Alicia and Horace, two Iraq war vets, check into a squalid motel after fire destroys the homeless shelter where they've been living. Alicia, a sergeant, was gang-raped by fellow soldiers in Iraq and suffers from severe post-traumatic stress disorder. The Army has been giving her the runaround ever since she reported the rape and wound up discharged. Benefits, housing, and most of all, legal recourse, all seem non-existent. Horace, a corporal who served with her, showed up some months ago to act as her protector. Kaliswa Brewster plays Alicia as a woman whose hold on the world around her has become increasingly tenuous. Her flashbacks are overtaking her everyday life. And even Horace is someone she barely remembers.
And the flashbacks are getting worse. I can't go to the grocery store. The slightest noise, a truck backfires, and I want to run or crouch down on the ground and scream. My friends don't talk to me anymore. I can barely hold a conversation.
In a lineup of plays dealing with pressing issues, One Night stands out as a play peopled with carefully drawn characters caught in frighteningly suspenseful situations. The play holds your interest at the same time that it raises your ire over the government's treatment of those who risked their lives in its service. Christina Anderson's play, The Ashes Under Gate City, is one of three world premieres at this summer's festival, and its subject matter is the most distinctive. Full disclosure, the playwright and I were fellow students at Brown for a year. Anderson imagines a city in Oregon that burned down and, when it was rebuilt, forgot, that is, excluded, its black citizens.
I don't understand.
The survivors rebuilt a city that had no room for black people.
You mean segregation.
I mean disregard. You can't segregate someone you don't consider.
This explanation comes from a self-help guru who is called Simone the Believer. Daphne Gaines gives a firm but low-key portrayal of Simone, who decides to right the town's wrongs by founding a black community there. The Ashes Under Gate City combines snippets of history, the strong themes of community activism and combating racism, and a character study of a charismatic and manipulative cult leader. The play is an original and, in the end, disturbing account of taking justice into your own hands. Two of the festival's other plays have two-person casts and deal with hot-button topics. In Chisa Hutchinson's Dead and Breathing, the topic is the right to die. A wealthy, mean-spirited cancer patient has hired and fired 16 hospice nurses. She meets her match in number 17, a nurse who claims to be, quote, in it for the long haul. Dead and Breathing contains a surprise. It would be a bigger surprise with more careful casting. And there's a deus ex machina ending that is definitely not earned. But Lizanne Mitchell gives a no-holds-barred portrayal of the ornery cancer patient, and we get to know and care about these two characters over the course of the play. If Dead and Breathing occasionally drifts away from drama into debate, Thomas Gibbon's Uncanny Valley sometimes feels like a TED Talk. The topic, can a robot, a highly advanced robot, develop consciousness? Can it learn to not only think, but feel? Gibbon's cast consists of a scientist and a robot. Starting out as just a head and shoulders, and eventually gaining a body and limbs, Alex Podolsky plays this automaton with a voice and movements that progress from mechanical to almost human. Barbara Kingsley is the scientist.
My role is, I suppose you could say, to teach you how to be as human as possible.
In many ways, Uncanny Valley is a modern take on Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, in which the creature goes out of control. In this case, the situation is exacerbated by wealth and greed. Playwright Gibbons was inspired by a National Geographic article about a project to transfer human consciousness to robots. But like the robot itself, this play lacks the flesh and blood needed to be truly dramatic. The festival's fifth offering, North of the Boulevard, is its most elaborately staged. Set designer David M. Barber has created a grimy inner-city auto repair shop, complete with a Nissan Altima and a refrigerator with a beer tap on the door. Playwright Bruce Graham got his start doing stand-up, and while he has a way with one-liners and naturalistic dialogue, reality is not necessarily drama. The play takes a long time to go anywhere, and in the end, its protagonist, the decent, hard-working owner of the garage, makes an abrupt decision that seems totally out of character. North of the Boulevard had a previous production in Philadelphia, but like an old car with a bad transmission, it's ultimately not roadworthy. Most of these plays are in various stages of development. Charles Fuller's One Night had an off-Broadway run this past winter, but the playwright continues to work on it. Christina Anderson rewrote The Ashes Under Gate City extensively in Shepherdstown. Thomas Gibbons' Uncanny Valley is part of the National New Play Network and has three more productions coming up. The process the Contemporary American Theater Festival makes available to its playwrights is at least as important as the productions it offers its audiences. After nearly a quarter century, those audiences can rely on it as a mecca for new, hard-hitting drama. Die-hard theatergoers can take in all five plays in just 2 days. And the ride home will find you mulling over injustices plaguing everything from the military to race, social class, and even science.
The Contemporary American Theater Festival is on the campus of Shepherd University in Shepherdstown, West Virginia. The festival concludes on August 3rd. Come to wipr.org/Maryland Morning for a link to the schedule for the next couple of weeks. Next Monday, J. Wynn Russick will be back to talk about a production of Legally Blonde at Cockpit in Court. You're listening to Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Tomorrow night, two young authors, Katia D. Ulysses from Haiti and Tiffany Unique from St. Thomas, Virgin Islands, will read from their debut novels at the Enoch Pratt Library in Baltimore. Miss Ulysses' book, Drifting, is a collection of interlinked short stories about four Haitian families. I'll be speaking with her about that book in the fall. And this morning, Tiffany Unique joins me on the line from New York to talk about her fascinating book, Land of Love and Drowning. It tells the story of the Bradshaw family, how their lives and loves are intertwined and inextricably informed by the idyllic, magical islands and its complex history. Tiffany Unique, welcome to Maryland Morning.
Thank you for having me, Tom. Pleasure to be here.
So this book is terrific. I really enjoyed it. Let's start by talking about the location, the Virgin Islands. It takes place in a number of the Virgin Islands, St. Thomas, St. John, St. Croix, and a sort of really magical place called Anegada. Tell us about how this location, permeates everything in this novel.
If anybody knows anything about the Virgin Islands, it's about how beautiful it is. But we don't often know so much as tourists about the Virgin Islands as a place of intellectual stimulation and culture outside of carnival culture. So I really wanted to explore the coming together of that beautiful land and really the beautifully rich people as well.
Early in the novel, we hear about the celebrations for Transfer Day. where control of the Virgin Islands is transferred from the Dutch to the United States. How was that such a formative event in the history of the Virgin Islands?
In 1917, the Virgin Islands, which was then the Danish West Indies, gets transferred from Danish rule, Denmark, to U.S. rule. So the U.S. effectively buys us from Denmark. That's a huge transformation in our cultural identity. Lucky for us, we had already been speaking English, but in other ways, we were definitely Danish and most definitely Caribbean, West Indian. And being American was a whole new kind of thing. And to be honest, it took us, the entirety of the 20th century to really begin to understand what effects this new Americanization had on the Virgin Islands. And I say we because I'm also a Virgin Islander.
Mm-hmm. And thanks for the correction. I said Dutch and I misspoke there. It's Danish control. That's a very different thing.
Common mistake, actually.
Yeah. Several real historical events transpire in the course of the novel. One of the most important events in the history of the islands is the appearance of Hurricane Mary. And there's a big scene, several scenes concerning that here in the book. How did that change life on the island?
So Hurricane Mary is not a real hurricane. The hurricanes that I'm basing Hurricane Mary on are Hurricane Hugo and Hurricane Marilyn. Hugo in the 80s and Marilyn in the 90s. And both these hurricanes affected the Virgin Islands tremendously. It really destroyed many of the physical infrastructures on the island. But you know, it also did a funny thing to our cultural awareness because suddenly we didn't have TV, we didn't have access to regular radio, we didn't have electricity. I personally, growing up on St. Thomas, didn't have electricity for 3 months after Hurricane Marilyn. And in many ways, it pushed us back to a time when in the early 1900s, before we had become so, we might use the word modern, or in the Virgin Islands case, American. So we began to really, I think, rethink what it meant to be from the Virgin Islands.
Let's talk about a couple of the characters, a few of the characters that we meet in the course of the book. It begins with Owen Arthur, the sort of patriarch of this family who's married to a woman named Antoinette. Owen Arthur is a ship captain. Tell us a little bit about him.
He is influenced a little bit by the story of my true great-grandfather. In 1926, my great-grandfather's ship, the Fancy Me, went down off the coast of what was then called Santo Domingo. Now we know it as the Dominican Republic. And the going down of that ship, and he went down with it, was a huge change in the Virgin Islands culture and history, but particularly in my family. Our family went from being a middle-class, upper middle-class family to quickly being a working-class, financially struggling family almost overnight. And that's how my story has been influenced by the true story, my story, this novel. Because Owen Arthur Bradshaw, as you quickly learn, does leave his family. And that causes a huge shift in this family's prospects. But it's also a sort of metaphor for what happens when the Virgin Islands becomes American.
And his wife, Antoinette, she dreams of coming to the United States.
Antoinette is hopefully dreaming, aspiring to be a fashion designer. She makes intricate, beautiful lace gloves and dresses and shawls and hats. And these things are useful and thought of as sort of a woman's hobby on the island, but she wants it to be much more.
And two of their daughters, of Antoinette's daughters, Iona and Annette, fascinating characters, and we learn a lot about them. And one of the first things we learn is that they were both extremely beautiful women, and that beauty really shapes their relationships with people and people's reactions to them. Talk a little bit about Iona and what's going on in her development throughout the novel.
She, I think, comes to understand her beauty as kind of a curse and a gift that throughout the book she tries to figure out how to utilize this to help her get to a place of stability and to accomplish her own dreams. In some ways, I'm thinking about her beauty as also being a reference to the natural beauty of the Virgin Islands, a place that is so stunningly beautiful that often we don't know how to treat it. And then often we sully it in our attempt to enjoy it. So Iona sometimes is sullied by those who find her most attractive.
And her sister Annette has an interesting series of relationships, and we won't give too much away, but one of them becomes, you know, very, very troubled. But she's also quite a unique and compelling character.
Annette is based lightly on my grandmother. One of the things that both these sisters, Iona and Annette, have is a type of magic. Annette has a magic that makes men fall in love with her. She has a bubbly, incredibly effusive, positive personality like my grandmother. And that makes men want to be close to her and want to be in her orbit.
I want to talk real quickly as we finish up about your wonderful storytelling technique and your use of forecasting what happens to people in the future. Oftentimes, right after we meet them, you immediately sort of tell us where they end up or give us an idea of what happens ultimately, and then you fill in the story. That it's really effective, the way the story is structured. Had you used that technique in your previous book as a series of short stories? Is this something that you turn to often?
My first book is called How to Escape from a Leper Colony, and that's a collection of stories. So I thought I would master these strange techniques in my stories and then apply what I hope would be mastery to the novel. And yeah, I'm really interested in what it means to be an omniscient storyteller. What does it mean to know the whole story already? And I thought, well, if the narrator knows everything, then where's the mystery? I thought, well, the act of telling itself is interesting. Not what's going to happen necessarily, but how we find out what's going to happen. And so I wanted to play with that. What happens when we know the ending? If we know the ending already, why do we read? Well, hopefully we read for the beauty of the story.
Well, it is indeed a beautiful story. So thanks so much for writing it and for sharing your time this morning. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Tom.
Tiffany Yannick, her debut novel is called Land of Love and Drowning. She'll be reading from the book tomorrow night at the Enoch Pratt Central Library. She'll be appearing with the Baltimore-based writer Katia D. Ulysses, whose new collection of interlinking stories is called Drifting. You can meet both authors tomorrow night at 6:30 in the Poe Room at the Pratt. Come to WIPR.org/Maryland Morning. For more details. That's our show for today. Coming up Wednesday morning on Maryland Morning, Sheila will have a conversation about changes in Somerset County, and I'll talk to an historian about the history of Charles Street, which runs from the heart of Baltimore City to the hills of Baltimore County. That's all on tap for Wednesday, and we hope you'll be able to join us. Maryland Morning is an original production of Your Public Radio, WIPR, in Baltimore. When you come to our website, WIPR.org/Maryland Morning, you can learn more about what you've heard on the show, and you can catch something you've missed, or you can leave us a comment. The show is produced by Matt Purdy and Jamila Kay. Nathan Sterner directs and engineers. We've got production help from Brandon Block, Alexandra Kennedy, and Justina Latimer. For Sheila, Nathan, and the entire Maryland Morning team, I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.